This podcast is a proud member of the Lamb Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.
Welcome to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of low-budget cinema.
The sleep of reason gives birth to monsters.
Hi, I'm Chris, and along with Jeff, we're bringing you the very best and worst of horror, sci-fi, action, exploitation, kung fu, and women in prison movies from the 1970s to today. Be sure and check out reallyawfulmovies.com for reviews, interviews, lists, and terrific movie giveaways.
From our downtown Toronto headquarters, here's episode 33B, the special episode of the podcast. We had a chance to talk to Ty Singh, who is the programmer of the Bristol Bad Film Club.
The other BBFC.
Yes, and his website is www.bristolbadfilmclub.co.uk.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going well. How's it going with you?
Good.
I like the shark there.
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah, my big inflatable shark from when I went to a screening in London of Shark Attack 3.
Give us the lowdown on the Bristol Bad Film Club, how it came to be.
Well, basically, like you guys, I love, you know, cult films or films that are, you know, so bad they're awesome.
Right.
And basically, I've always watched kind of crappy monster movies and stuff as a kid. So, a couple of years ago, I was just having a standard bad movie night with some friends, and we had a double bill of Samurai Cop. And this was before Samurai Cop had became kind of what it is now, so it was before Matt Hannon had come back from the dead.
Right, right.
A sequel. And we also watched The Room, and I was kind of thinking that there's nowhere where we live that kind of did these screenings.
Right.
And there's the Prince Charles Cinema in London, where Tommy Wiseau every now and then shows up to do a screening. But there was nowhere really in Bristol that did them, so me and a friend decided that it shouldn't be too hard to put on these screenings, and the problem is that you're never going to make a lot of money from doing film screenings, so we decided that all the profit should really go to charity.
Oh.
And that's it, really. We started doing Plan 9 from Outer Space above a pub. 50 people came, and it sold out. And from there on in, it's just been as popular. So, yeah.
So do you guys just show the movies, or do you guys do like a bit of a commentary, a Q&A? What's a typical BBFC screen like?
Basically, I introduce the films.
Okay.
I always think with these films, sometimes the story of how they were made is more interesting than the film themselves.
Awesome, yep.
I like to give it a bit of context. So, when we showed Paul Gasari, which was the North Korean monster film, I mean, the story about how that was made is insane, that, you know, Kim Jong-il kidnapped directors from South Korea. So I introduced the film that way, and then we kind of watched the film, and then if anyone have questions at the end, if I can answer them, that's it, really. But the guy I started it with, he's dropped out to kind of form his own film club, so now it's just kind of a one-man show, and a couple of friends helped me out with logistics, but yeah, it's just me at the moment.
So how often do you have your screenings?
We do it once a month.
Right.
And we try and do different venues. As long as it's got a bar, that's kind of what we do.
Yep, well, yeah, that's when a bad movie and alcohol, I mean,
it's
like chocolate and peanut butter. You gotta have it. So what's the next screening?
The next screening is I've rented out the city's planetarium.
Mm-hmm.
Bristol's got a 3D planetarium, and we're showing Life Force there.
Awesome, awesome.
So I've got a nice high-def copy of that. I'm currently trying to track down Patrick Stewart to talk to him about it, because he trained at the Bristol Old Vic, so I'm trying to use that as a connection.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I've said, you know, the profits from the screening will go to Refuge, which is a charity he's a patron of.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I'm trying to interview Peter Firth, who plays Colonel Kane in the film.
Yep.
He's currently doing a press tour in England at the moment because they've just released the Spook film, which I think in America and Canada is called MI5. But here it's called Spooks. So he's on a press tour, and I'm trying to desperately get his agent to return my calls just to ask him about Life Force. But yeah,
and how about that Matilda May? Maybe
oh god, Matilda May. Yeah. I honestly would just be flustered. I wouldn't know what to say. I'd just be like, hi, hello.
I hear you. You spent three quarters of the movie walking around the complete all together, and
you got the
most incredible body I've ever seen. And speaking of which, I mean, you spoke to David Hasselhoff recently.
Yeah,
that was a great interview. I really enjoyed reading the interview.
Thanks.
And one thing, because it's funny, because a lot of people disown their B movie past, right?
Yeah.
Where it seems like the Hoff sort of embraced it, and.
Yeah.
And the fact that Star Crash is one of my all-time favorite movies, and his stories about Star Crash are really, really funny.
No, I was about to say, he completely embraces the Hoff persona.
Exactly.
And I think maybe from his point of view, he's probably just used to people talking to him about Baywatch or Knight Rider.
Right.
So, yeah, he was really forthcoming. I mean, when he mentioned it, it was like, oh, I couldn't stop staring at Carolyn Monroe's tits.
That was it. When you said, well, I mean, we're distracted by her outfits. No, I wasn't distracted by her outfits. I was distracted by her tits. I mean,
but it was great. It's like he had no kind of filter.
Exactly.
His assistant is his nephew.
Right.
And, yeah, he just seemed really up for it. And before I interviewed him, I did some research. And when Baywatch first started, apparently it flopped. The first season flopped, and he bought the rights to it off NBC. And when it was a hit, he was like executive producer, and he sold all the rights back.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard he made like $100 million from Baywatch throughout its entire run. So he doesn't need to do what he does. He just loves being the Hoff. He loves performing. So I think he was just really candid, and finding out that he auditioned to be Indiana Jones and was one of the many, many, many people that auditioned to be Superman, it was like, this is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's weird how big he is in Germany. I was living there at the time, and I was trying to rustle up some friends to go see him live.
Really?
And no,
I did not know that.
No one would bite. And then what made me laugh is they were selling the tickets at the equivalent of the German like 7-Eleven. So it's just this pathetic enterprise there. But yeah, he's huge, and I guess he does sort of weird covers like Can I Borrow a Feeling or something. What are some of the hits he does? I have no idea.
Yeah, he did a cover of More Than a Feeling.
Yeah.
Mm.
It was Looking for Freedom was the one that he sung on top of the Berlin Wall.
That was his big hit in Germany. Now, I wonder when you interviewed him, was it face-to-face, via phone, via Skype? What was he?
It was going to be via phone, and then the line dropped out, and then I had to email my questions, and he recorded his answers and sent them through to me. So it started off on the phone, but then it kind of dropped out, and he essentially just recorded all his answers and sent them through to me.
Because I wonder if he was rolling around on the floor eating a hamburger while...
No, but he did sound... It must have been in the evening for him.
Yeah.
It sounded like maybe he was halfway through dinner.
Yeah.
I don't want to say he had been drinking a few beers. I'm saying he probably had dinner.
You remember that video, right? When he was rolling around the floor eating that hamburger.
Oh, God, that hamburger. That's insane. Yeah.
He had that sort of 70s muscle tone that a lot of these guys had. Because everyone now is in sort of good shape.
Yep.
And he had that sort of slightly hirsute, sort of like former athlete kind of physiognomy. Is that the word?
Yeah.
Physicality.
Whatever,
sort of like George Hamilton or even I guess we're going to talk about Robert Forrester.
Sort of like Burt Reynolds, all the cosmopolitan.
Burt Reynolds
in
Deliverance. That kind of...
Sean Connery in Zardoz.
There you go,
Yeah. Not ripped, toned and unashamedly hairy.
Yeah. It's like an 80s WWF jobber sort of physique.
I'm going to shake myself. It's just like, here I am. I'm all out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you got to love that. And another upcoming screening, which I mean, obviously we're on the other side of the pond, but I mean... If I was there, I would be there. You're going to be screening the Canon documentary, right? Electric Boogaloo. Have you had a chance to watch it yet?
Yes, I have seen it because it's been out in general release in Australia, and a friend of mine who's in Australia sent me a copy. I think it's only had one screening in the UK, and that was at the BFI.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's been screened all over the world now, and it's on general release, I think, in June in the UK, and mm-hmm. I think I'm going to be the only place in Bristol screening it, which is great for me. It's like I'm a one-man cult film club,
mm-hmm.
and I spoke to Metrodome, who are the distributors, and I was like, I want to show you a film, and then I want to get, you know, our people to vote for what canon classic they want to see it with, and they were like, that's an amazing idea, here you go. You can have it at this reduced rate. And I was like, that's amazing. So I can't wait to screen that. And it's an insane documentary. It's
Good. We actually both had the pleasure of seeing it. And, I mean, I was watching the thing with a grin from ear to ear from, like, frame one to the last. It was so entertaining. And, I mean, some of the stories, I mean, my favorite story, I got to say, was Menachem Golan negotiating with Clive the Monkey. Directly.
Oh, God, yeah.
That was beyond belief, but...
And I love how their star system consisted of Chuck and Chuck. So that was it.
Chuck and Chuck.
Which ones for... And he was getting long in the tooth at that point by the time they had him. Bronson.
Yeah, he was definitely long in the tooth, yep. And what about the whole...
Death Wish 3, he looked like he had just checked out mentally and physically.
But how...
Minimal movement.
How batshit insane is Death Wish 3? I mean, that's... You know what I mean? Like
the stories. Was it Alex Winter from Bill and Ted?
Yes.
And he's like a punk in that. And the stories he was telling, it's insane. But I think my favorite story was where they were talking to Richard Chamberlain about making King Solomon's Mines.
Mm-hmm.
And it was one of the producers where I think it was Golan said, go out and get that stone girl.
Kathleen Turner.
Sharon Stone. They made the entire film, showed it to him. He was like, no. The one that was in Romancing the Stone, Kathleen Turner, and they were like, oh, for God's sake.
Yeah. So they got Sharon Stone, everybody despised her, and oh, just the best. I miss canon. I wish you
were.
So what are the two films that are up for contention?
Actually, I put about eight up.
Okay.
Eight different films. So I put Delta Force, The Apple, Electric, Boogaloo, Bloodsport, but the two favourites, the ones that have got the most votes, are Over the Top, because everyone loves an arm wrestling movie, and Ninja 3, The Domination, because that's just insane.
See, that to me, like that's Sophie's Choice. I mean, those are two incredible movies. I love the shit out of both of them, right? I mean, Ninja 3 is, I mean, for just sheer lunacy, you gotta go with Ninja 3, but I mean, Over the Top, I mean... Why was there only one movie made about arm wrestling? There should have been more. There should have been, like, I mean, this should have been the next big thing, but...
It pans down my favorite arm wrestling film. I can't say that.
You know what? I mean, considering the fact that the pool is quite limited, I would say I tend to agree.
Well, maybe axe throwing would be next?
Oh, God, no. Is that big over there in the UK like it is here in... That's where this is the new trend here.
New awful like hipster urban awful thing where you go into a bar and some backyard and you whip an axe around and hopefully
has not taken on.
I hope that has a short shelf life.
Yeah,
hopefully some arms are removed. I don't know what. That's pretty bad.
I'm hoping Ninja 3 is the one that's picked because for a moment it was going to be Bloodsport and. In March, we did a big Street Fighter screening, and I was kind of like, oh, God, is it going to be too soon for another Jean-Claude Van Damme film?
Right.
And a friend of mine was like, it's never too soon for another Jean-Claude Van Damme film. No, but Ninja 3 has kind of overtaken it, and I think, like you said, that's kind of the perfect storm of the madness that is canon films. So.
Without a doubt, yeah.
Yeah.
I love Ninja 3. Vigilante, we're going to talk about a film. Vigilante. This is a film from 1983, directed by one of our favorites, William Lustig, right? Who directed Maniac and Maniac Cop and Hit List and on and on and on. And Chris, what do you?
Yeah, I was just really surprised. I was just blown away by the aesthetic, and you know, we love New York, and it just made use of I think every borough and. It was phenomenal, and just a great speech just to start it off, too. It was almost the sort of Warriors-esque, well, the soundtrack was as well.
Oh, God, Fred Williamson when he was doing that speech, and it was amazing. Actually, I have to say, when I told a couple of people who are into their cult films that I know, that we were going to be talking about Vigilante. They were kind of dismayed that the Really Awful Movies podcast wanted to talk about Vigilante. They're like, hang on, that's just a straight-up great film.
It's a great film, and that's the thing.
It's a fantastic film. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
It was really good, and I hadn't seen it before. But yeah, the amount of people that were in it, and it was just really well-made, really good fun, and it just ended. It was like an hour 25, and it just seemed to suddenly end. I was like, what, that's it? This could go on another half an hour, and I'd be on board. But yeah, it was great.
The moral obligation for self-preservation.
Yes, exactly, yeah.
Yeah, he goes, this is our Waterloo, baby. You want your city back? Take it. Great, great speech. No, I mean, the thing is, I mean, we're the Really Awful Movies podcast, where we talk about good movies, bad movies, and everything in between, and were we expecting something a little bit more awful? Maybe, but damn, it was a great, great movie. I mean, it's really hard to sort of rip on it. It was just a kick-ass good movie.
And especially, they went through all the trouble of using Rikers Island prison as well. And so that just added some heavy-duty atmospheres. That's the institution I would not want to be sent to. If I had to pick a jail, well, that and the San Quentin, I guess. Take your pick. I don't know if I'd fare well in any jail, but let's say that one for sure.
No. Mm.
Like, Rikers is scary as hell. And it's on an island, like, right outside of Manhattan. It's
sure,
creepy.
Yeah.
It's got, like, 10,000 inmates. It's just, we would not fare well there. And, yeah, they put, you know, the inmates, I guess, were, disrupting the filming in that segment. They were banging on things, so that it created some nice ambient noise.
Yeah.
But, yeah, and Robert Forster is just always, like, that sad sack face he's got is amazing. Just from, well, Jackie Brown, Alligator is one of our favorites.
I was just saying, because an alligator, I mean, it was like this sort of this running joke with Forster where he's losing his hair, and I thought that was the end of it, but then, you know, as soon as we see him in...
he reprised his...
as soon as we see him in Vigilante, he's like, hey, you're looking good. He's like, well, I'm losing my hair a little bit, so...
he looked really young in Vigilante, actually. I was surprised by how young he looked.
Mm.
Especially in the shower scene, I was like, the man clearly working out for this film.
Yeah, well...
He was looking spry.
Well, let's talk a bit about that shower scene. Interesting scene, eh?
Yeah, I actually read that the guy who essentially wants Robert Forster was head of the Hell's Angels.
Mm-hmm.
He was a member, and after this film was locked up for murder.
Wow.
Like, Jesus, what? I mean, the guy was massive. He was terrifying. But, the fight scene that he has with Woody Strode actually slammed his head into the tiles.
Yeah.
For real. So I was like, that's insane. Don't mess with Woody.
Good for Woody, man. And that was a cool fight scene. Lots of kidney punches. It was all about...
Yeah, it was the best naked fight scene I'd seen since Eastern Promises.
Eastern Promises, yeah.
Eastern Promises, I was thinking of that, yeah.
That's a fine distinction right there.
Yeah.
And but again, Woody Strode must have been about 60, 70, and he was still looking ripped.
Oh, yeah.
His arms were massive. I mean, I always think of him, you know, in Spartacus and the beginning of Once Upon a Time in the West.
Right, yep.
It was weird seeing him kind of with that old man Tash, but when it came down to it, when he was throwing down, it was still like, yeah, man, I can still see this guy as a gladiator.
Yeah, no, he kicked ass. I mean, the thing about it is, too, I mean, the cast was incredible. I mean, unfortunately, some of the people I really wanted to see in the movie were only in it for a scene or two, such as, for example,
Joe Spinell.
But
the greasy public attorney there.
Yeah, but he was so Joe Spinell. I mean, that's the whole thing. I mean, what did you say? What was he likened to in the you were talking about in the director's commentary?
Oh, I can't tell. I can't recall, but he was apparently, you know, incredibly coked out during the filming, and they couldn't find him in the courtroom scene, so they have a lot of cutaways where they had to pretend he was there, and then they finally rustled him up from God knows where.
Did you say he was like the Marsha Clark of, like, public...
Oh, no, no, he's the defense attorney, but the other, yeah, we were just talking about the terrible legal team that Marino had in this courtroom, and I guess someone said it was the Marsha Clark of defense attorneys, but which is a dated reference to the OJ case, but still, like, she was just awful.
Yeah, he was not great. I had no idea why they were paying him so much money. He was a terrible lawyer, but like you said, I also read that he kind of went AWOL.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
They had to trawl the bars of New York finding him.
Yep. And, I mean, again, like, you know, it's hilarious because here's poor Robert Forster's character, Eddie Marino. I mean, the guy's son was blown away with just an incredible shotgun blast.
Jesus Christ, yeah, when that... When his brains come out of that bathroom window, I was like, holy shit.
Yeah.
I really went down on this.
And, you know, that was actually the same shotgun that was used in Maniac, from what I found on IMDb, yeah.
Well.
In the infamous scene, where, you know, where Tom Savini gets his head blown off. But, I mean...
I did not notice that, and I've got Maniac off on Blu-ray. God, that, no, I should have picked up on that, mm-hmm. But yeah.
Yeah, his son is blown away with a shotgun, his wife is in a coma, he goes to prison to see some justice, and he gets arrested for contempt of court, you know?
And we should say that they only called his comatose wife as a witness, but there were other people in the mechanic shop who witnessed it, and they were never subpoenaed.
Yeah, like the guy that has petrol poured all over him. And
yeah,
you never see him again.
At least five people witnessed that, and I guess they never came forward, and that was it.
They had one way. We'll call one witness, but unfortunately she's in a coma, therefore...
Yeah. They should have cleared that. You would have thought, you know?
To be fair, Robert Forster's family, they could not have foreshadowed their deaths any worse. It's like they're lying in the park. The son's playing with a kite, and they're like going, you know what, we should definitely spend more time together as a family, and
exactly.
We can take a trip. And you're just sitting there going, oh dear God, don't lay it on any thicker. And they're just going, oh, this is the perfect afternoon. And then just chaos.
And then, you know, I mean, as you're saying about the guy getting the gasoline or the petrol portal, I mean, a bit of an overreaction just for $10 worth of gas, wouldn't you say? I mean, you know, not being able to pay, just a little extreme, I'd say.
Well, that's the other thing. I thought that the guy with the beard that was pouring the petrol over the guy, I thought he was going to be the main bad guy.
Mm. Yeah, Melendez?
Melendez. And then he kind of takes a back seat to the proceedings, and they... catch up with him later, and it's the other guy that's...
Yeah, I guess they had to you know, devote more screen time to Willie Colon, because I believe he was sort of he's like a Puerto Rican salsa
superstar.
That surname just makes me laugh because I have a brain of a 13-year-old. But there was an NFL player whose name was Harry Colon. But if you read it out, then it's Harry Colon, and it's a, so there you go.
But that's another thing, that he was the main bad guy, and it should technically, the film should end with his death being the final death. And the way it ends, I mean, we're jumping forward a bit, and it just ends with him kind of ending the judge.
Mm-hmm.
When you think about it, it's like, well, yeah, he was a crap and corrupt judge, but you could have taken him out earlier. It's like, it seemed a really kind of unsatisfying end to the movie. It's like, oh, and you've just killed the judge, just to make sure.
But yeah, it's interesting too, because I mean, you have the tale of Williamson and his sort of group of vigilantes, right? Mm-hmm. And they sort of want to conscript Robert Forster into their group, but he's sort of part of it, but not really. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's like there were two films kind of going on concurrently. Because
exactly.
Fred William and his gang are trying to clean up the streets, and there's that bit where Fred Williamson's watching the TV, and you see that the mafia businessman who goes, just because I dress well, that doesn't mean I... deal narcotics. And I was like, oh, this is going to be like
foreshadowing
the movie, who's then killed like halfway through. I was like, oh, it's not him then.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it is like two different films that you think are going to merge up towards the end, but they never really fully do.
No, they don't. It's sort of like, almost like, I guess like through osmosis and knowing Fred Williams, I mean, it kind of brought Fred Williams, it brought Robert Forster into the sort of like, okay, well, let's take the law. I mean, there's that line, like, you always want to be a victim and so on and so forth. I mean, nobody was more of a victim that I've seen than Robert Forster in this movie, the poor guy, you know what I mean? Like, the guy was getting every calamity thrown at him.
And then his wife left him.
And then his wife left him, yeah, exactly, which gets out of the coma. I mean, to insult to injury, his wife left him. That was
to be fair.
Okay, here we go. Yeah.
To be fair, the guy was, you know, boozing it up with his mates when he could have. He's got a young kid at home, and every night at the beginning of this movie, he's just out and he's working long hours. He's just never home at all.
That is a good point. But then, if we're talking about hanging out and boozing with your mates, I think we need to start talking about Steve James's incredibly relaxed police officer.
Yes, yeah.
To know about everything that's going on. It's like, guys, I know it was you. Let's not do this. Don't do it. Because, you know, I'm just going to have to come arrest you. I'm not going to.
It was sort of weird, speaking of him, and this, we were talking about the Warriors earlier, the sort of the odd racial politics in this, because
yeah.
I would have anticipated the mobster guy being an Italian, and he's... What's his surname? I forget. He's just... It's Stokes or something? But he was just some
Right.
Yeah, some generic white guy.
Mr. T. Thomas Stokes. Yeah.
Stokes. And you would expect, being New York City, that the guy would either be Jewish, Russian, or Italian.
Okay.
But that would... And so they sort of excise that bit, and then they have, I guess, for a vigilante movie, they sort of have... You know, the main protagonist is a black guy and one of the cops, so it sort of tempers a lot of the potential racial animus they might have had, and they did the same in Warriors. Because Warriors, they were supposed to be an all-black gang, or all Puerto Rican. Mm-hmm. All Puerto Rican, I should say, and then they made them like a, you know, like a UN kind of gang, so to...
I'm going to say that I don't think any racial minority comes off well in this film.
That's true.
Apart from... You know, it does appear that Steve James is like the one good cop who no one listens to.
Right.
But again, being Steve James, when he walked into that bar, he was wearing a police uniform that looked about three sizes too small for him.
That is very true, yeah.
He looked like a male stripper.
Yeah, should have jumped out of a cake.
Rip off his shirt. You know, like he does in American Ninja, but I just kind of kept looking at him going... If he just flexes, the shirt's just going to tear away.
And we were talking... Sorry, go ahead, sorry.
No, that was it.
Okay, we were talking about Stokes, Mr. T. I mean, we're talking about shotgun blasts. I mean, what a shotgun blast.
Incredible
Mr.
squib
T.
use.
And when Steve James, I mean, I guess spoiler alert, but when he meets his maker, Officer Gibbons, I mean, what a... He got just shot to shit, man. That was awesome.
That was incredible.
That's another thing. When they're all shot, there's in the gang there is the one blonde woman with a beret. You know, everyone else is like Mexican or black,
Rican,
and there's this one blonde woman who's just hanging around with them. She's just always there. And I thought, oh, we're gonna is there something interesting about her? It's like, no, she's just there.
Mm-hmm.
And does she even get her comeuppance? I can't remember now.
I don't think so.
I don't think
she doesn't have any lines either.
Not really. Eh?
No. But she's just there. She kills Steve James as well when they open up the side of the truck and shoot him. And...
Well, what about...
Well, I remember thinking that's an interesting take to have.
Mm-hmm. And what about poor Horace the Pimp? I mean, he got he definitely got his comeuppance at the hands of Fred Williamson and his vigilantes.
Oh, God, yeah. That's the thing. The vigilante thing. It's just... Fred Williamson and his crew... They beat up a couple of people, and then he really only cropped up to kind of dispense advice about how messed up the world is.
Exactly. Yep. And that's the whole thing. I mean, like, as you're saying before, I mean, there's these two sort of stories going on. I mean, and they don't necessarily converge in any sort of, like, meaningful way, except you have Fred Williamson as this, like, Yoda of, like, being a vigilante, right? And Robert Forster is, like, sort of like a Luke Skywalker, like, you know, but instead of, like, come to the dark side and be, like, with us, because this is our Waterloo, we gotta take back the city. But you know what? At the end of the day, it was a kick-ass movie. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Is there Waterloo?
Yeah,
I don't know if I care for that historical analogy. It really makes no sense, but anyway.
But we're all going to lose.
Do you care for the song by ABBA?
No,
I don't either. Waterloo.
The one justifiable bit with the vigilante aspect of the story is when Forrest's wife calls the police. And she's like, you know, there are these people outside my house. And the cop on the end of the phone... is so laid back. He's like, oh, Jesus, calm down, lady. All right, we'll send a patrol car. I was like, well, in this case, I can see why there's vigilantes. The cops here are terrible.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're just telling this woman to stop being so damn hysterical, and we'll get there when we feel like it.
Yeah, it's so weird. It makes you wonder if anything like this would be made today.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is sort of a genre that doesn't seem, especially in light of, you know, what happened in Baltimore and whatnot.
Yeah.
It's sort of interesting, especially given New York has, you know, its crime rate is practically, you know, it's become one of the more safe cities in the U.S.
Sure. Yep.
Yeah, and you can't say that about like New Orleans or you know, Chicago or something, but you don't see these movies being made anymore.
No,
it's a different kind of politics.
Yeah, yeah, the 70s and early 80s were like the heyday of the vigilante movie. I mean, of course, your Death Wish and everything, and this
or even RoboCop.
Sure.
To a degree, even though he was more benevolent, but still, there's something incredibly creepy about you know, some pre-programmed cyborg thing. You know, who's
mm-hmm.
Well, it's amazing when you kind of see these cities, and you're like, I mean, I've been to New York, and it's like, oh, God, I can't imagine what the city must have been like back then. But, yeah, these vigilante movies are definitely kind of a product of the time that they were made. But, yeah, considering with everything that kind of is going on in the States, you can see a film like this being made now and just kind of... You can just imagine the cable news shows just tearing it apart, going
Yep.
You know, it's kind of encouraging violence and it would be a nightmare.
And there was some of that. I mean, back in the day with Death Wish and everything, but I think nowadays in the hyper politically correct times we live in, I mean, it would certainly be a nightmare. I mean, everybody does, I think, love a good vigilante. I mean, look at The Punisher. I mean, the comic book, right?
Yeah.
I mean, although they've yet to really make a good... Well, that's not true. I really did like Punisher Warzone. Have you seen that one?
I bloody love Punisher Warzone.
Yeah,
I think it's... I mean, I like the Dolph Lundgren one, but in terms of all, you know, insane levels of violence...
It's fucking awesome, man.
The opening 10 minutes, he puts like a chair leg through someone's face.
Yeah.
Astounding. I don't know if you guys have ever listened to it, but the How Did This Get Made episode for Punish the War Zone, they get on Lexi Alexander, who's the director.
Okay, yes.
Captain Oswald. And they just kind of talk about the challenges she had making the film. And it's really fascinating because she's like, you know, this level of violence, it's all from the comics. I'm not like a psychopath or anything. But, you know, it's all these people that are like, you know, you should really have a full on. Out there, Punisher film, and then when they make one, they're like, "Oh, Jesus, this is a bit too much."
Yeah,
but I really like it, and I really like Ray Stevenson.
He's incredible. He's incredible. I mean, he doesn't look like Frank Castle like in the comic. Do you know what I mean? But that doesn't really matter because he's just so fucking badass.
He's been living in the sewers.
Exactly. Yeah.
A bit dodgy, but he still punch you through the face.
And then you got Wayne Knight, Newman. I mean, he get you know in there, and it's pretty incredible. So getting back to the bad movies, what would you say? I mean, this is, I guess, you know, I'm putting you on the spot a bit here, but I mean, you know, how would you define? First of all, I was going to ask you what your favorite bad movies are. Well, in a second, I'll let you think about that for a moment or two. But like. You know, people ask us, like, you know, we call our site Really Awful Movies, right? And, I mean, it's not just about really awful movies. We got the name because, you know, Chris, you were saying your mother would say to you, like, why are you watching these?
Yeah, these awful movies. You get that comments from girlfriends as well. And, you know, they're not awful. We try and we celebrate and evangelize them. So,
yeah.
There's a tendency, I guess, for some people, I guess also in the podcast community to be sort of above these movies. But we want to champion them and... You know, love them.
But there's something so, like, satisfying about watching a good, bad movie. I mean, I'm trying to, like, put my finger on that. Maybe you can shed some light on that. What do you think?
I completely agree. I mean, the films that I screen, I believe, there's two things. There are the ones that they're so bad, they're just simply amazing. It's like a perfect storm. Often it's the films that are made... starring or directed or produced by like just one figure, like Amir Shavan in with Samurai Cop.
Right, yeah.
That is just one guy writing and directing it, so this is just one man's vision. And same with Tommy Wiseau with The Room.
The Room, of course, yeah.
Yeah, it's. So I think the best bad films are where it's kind of unchecked ego and there was no studio system to kind of rein them in.
Right.
But since that, a lot of the films we've shown, like I did a big outdoor screening of Masters of the Universe last year, And I got a lot of stick with people going, it's not a bad movie, it's an amazing movie. And I was like, I love Master of the Universe 2, but let's not kid ourselves, it's not that great. And, I agree with you. I mean, you've got to be entertained by these films. And I love Master of the Universe, and all these films that I show, I genuinely love them. But you can't kid yourself that these are great films by any stretch of the imagination. It's just the passion that went into them just kind of often outweighs all the talent that was involved. So people threw everything they had into it. They just didn't have the skills to make it a success. And that's why I really like these films, because it's like the film that tries so hard and fails, especially Samurai Cop. Right. Samurai Cop, I would say, is a prime example of this. He's trying to make like a Lethal Weapon film, but the director was Iran, so it's film culture there. You know, he plays up melodrama, and there's just gratuitous nudity for no reason, and there's a whole great thing that Matt Hannon cut his hair.
Oh, that's incredible. I mean,
with a wig on for most of it, and then it falls off in his fight scene. And I would say that's it. It's where it's unchecked enthusiasm and passion that's not really backed up with the skill set required. But I'm with you guys. I love these films, and I often feel that calling ourselves the Bristol Bad Film Club kind of makes people think we're mocking these films, but like you said, I think it's more of a celebration of them, and I'm trying to get them out to a wider audience. I want people to see Samurai Cop. I want them to see Miami Connection and Troll 2 and
another one of our favorites. Yeah, that is our mandate as well. I mean, we mock them, but it's with affection and it's with admiration, because I mean, getting a movie made is fucking hard. You know what I mean? And when you have a passion and you get this movie made, and I think you said it was unchecked ego, I believe you said, and a bit of lunacy as well. You know?
Yeah.
And when they put these things on the screen, and 9 times out of 10, they're more entertaining than most of the crap that Hollywood throws out at us, right? So, Chris, you were going
to
say something?
Oh, no. Have you had a chance to check out Get Even?
I knew you were going to talk about Get Even. This is our favorite. It's not Get Even, Chris. It's Get Even. Get Even.
Get Even. Yeah.
Get Even. This is a movie.
There's a space bar problem on the DVD.
They actually did.
They put the two words together. So it's Get Even, but it's also called Road to Revenge.
I've never heard of it. Tell me about it.
It's a vanity project that was the brainchild of an L.A. attorney.
John DeHart. Okay.
Yeah, and he fancied himself an action hero, and he also does the soundtrack.
He sings.
He sings in the movie.
He actually sings. He sort of like sings over his own love scenes, which is kind of ridiculous.
Yeah, and he directs, produces, stars, and everything. And this one, I think this has to be given
more,
top
yeah.
billing. This is the worst film I've ever seen. And it's gotten a second life, recently, I think. Has it not?
Well, we're championing it, so I mean.
And what's unique about it is that I guess it has a few notable stars.
Well, it's got one, Wings Hauser.
Wings Hauser, yeah.
Wings Hauser, who's acting his ass off, like it's like he's in another movie altogether.
Yeah, there's just some weird, exposition where this guy just inserts references to Shakespeare that are not asked for at all. And he just says, have you heard about this Hamlet guy? He's in a bar and he's trying to do, soliloquies from Hamlet in the bar to an unreceptive audience of drunks. So it's just, this guy has an incredible vision, like a very lofty vision. And it's just
it's
fails.
It's kind of like the director of Birdemic, where he just starts talking about was an inconceivable truth in the middle of it. And like, oh, this is going to make me want to go out and buy a Prius. I'm going to start recycling right now.
The whole thing about Birdemic, I mean, it's all about the global warming. It's all global warming.
Have you guys seen Fateful Findings?
I'm sorry?
Have you seen Fateful Findings, Neil Breen's?
No,
I haven't seen it yet. I keep trying to track it down, and I've contacted him to try and send me a copy, but by all accounts, Neil Breen is the new Tommy Wiseau in terms of pure unchecked ego. It's another, I'm going to write, direct, produce, and star in my own film. This is my chance to get across everything that's important to me, to the world. And there was, I think there was this article about it on Badass Digest, and also BuzzFeed did a special about people from things. It looks incredible, but I'm trying very hard to try and get my a copy of that, but it's hard tracking it down, unfortunately, because Neil Breen owns all the rights and all the copies and everything, so...
Hmm. I'll have to definitely be on the lookout for that one, yeah.
Oh, yeah, you were mentioning Patrick Stewart earlier. I discovered this action film in Koreatown here where he's buried alive. And it's some sort of, it's almost like a Bananas-esque kind of film where there's, a revolutionary, it's a South American country that's not named. It's just a made-up.
Okay.
And, yeah, Patrick Stewart is just slumming it like nobody's business and getting buried alive. He's one of the evil characters. Wearing like a white sort of a Panama hat or something, and getting, yeah, I don't know what it's called, but well, I got it next door. But
yeah, this is more recent, right?
This is yeah,
more
this
recent
is very recent.
Yeah.
Well, was it recent?
Yeah.
Oh god, wasn't like mid-90s when he was making Death Train with Pierce Brosnan and stuff like that?
It's probably around there, yeah.
So if I get an interview with him, I'm definitely going to ask him about that.
Maybe talk about Dune as well.
Dune. Oh yeah, I think Dune. There are people talk to him about Dune all the time. I want to talk about the stuff that no one ever asks him about.
Right.
And that's always most like when I spoke to David Hasselhoff, I was just fascinated by Baywatch Nights when it started as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
It's like this is my chance to have all my questions about Baywatch Nights answered. So yeah, if I can, I try and ask the stuff that no one else has asked him, otherwise I would be able to read about it online.
True, true. Yeah.
Oh, it's called Gunman. And
Gunman.
It's got the always excellent Christopher Lambert, who's got to be, I think, one of the worst actors of all time.
Christopher Lambert? No one sports a bad wig like Christopher Lambert.
Except for maybe Matt Hannon, perhaps.
Except maybe Matt Hannon,
yeah.
But again, I want to see a film where Thomas Jane and Christopher Lambert are either a father and son team or just very old and young brothers and they're just sporting a selection of wigs.
Apparently he's had a resurgence doing French art films.
God.
Anyway, I'm just looking at this cover here for Gunman. I mean, we got Christopher Lambert, Mary Van Peebles, Dennis Leary, and Patrick Stewart. Why have I not watched this movie yet?
No, I was going to loan it to you.
Why are you hoarding this movie?
Because it's very similar to another one that features, a fictional South American country and a revolutionary, like a Bananas kind of theme. So I was getting them confused in my mind, so I had to separate them out.
What's the fake South American country that's used in Die Hard 2 and Commando that Steven E. D'Souza came up with? It's like Valencia or something.
Yeah, something along those lines, yeah.
Like generic South American country where everyone's a drug dealer.
Yep. It's like in DC Comics, they have the Karak. That's like, they're made up Middle Eastern country, right?
Right.
So, yeah. I mean, now here we go. We're going to put you on the spot. So, top five bad movies.
Oh, right. I'm going to go straight in at number one with Samurai Cop.
Mm-hmm.
I love Samurai Cop. I think The Room should probably go in there.
Okay, yep, definitely, yep.
Because we try and show The Room once a year and it always sells out. People love it. Monster movie. I feel like I should get a monster movie in there. I'm going to say Shark Attack 3, Megalodon, where John Barrowman fights a 60-foot killer shark. That's probably best known for the clip that you can see on YouTube where a man rides a jet ski down a shark's throat. That's pretty insane.
Wow.
I really like Miami Connection. That was quite special.
We
again,
love that.
Again, that is a... just White A. Kim again writing, directing, and starring because he wants to teach the world about
Taekwondo awareness.
Exactly, yeah. And in fact, have you seen that video on YouTube? Who is YK Kim? And it's like a video that's played before he does motivational speeches.
Mm-hmm, I've seen that, yeah.
That's pretty amazing. He is an evangelist of the martial arts.
Yeah.
That's four. I need one more. One more. Jim Carter. I'm going to go with Jim Carter.
Oh, man.
The U.S. gymnast that's hired to eventually, be hunted. Yeah.
How incredible.
That's another thing about these bad films. They, on a normal studio system, if you went to them and kind of went, I've got this idea where, a gymnast has to infiltrate a country and play their version of gladiators, they would go, no, that's stupid. sod off. But because they don't cost much, you're allowed to have the most batshit insane ideas, and they get made. It's amazing.
I know.
And that's why I love these films.
And speaking of Kim Cod, I mean, like, you know, here he is in some sort of, like, market in the middle of God knows fucking where, and he's got, like, some sort of pummel horse just there, you know? So he can do his, Gymkhana. I mean, it's incredible that every sort of like piece of gymnastic equipment he needs is there. A priori, you know, he needs it. Yeah, it's unbelievably good. I mean, that's or awful, whatever, however you want to say. But no,
it was directed by Robert Klaus, who did Enter the Dragon, which is like an amazing thing. But the whole thing about Gymkhana was that Kurt Thomas, he was like the U.S. gymnastics champion, and he missed out on going to the Olympic Games because it was the year that the U.S. decided to boycott the Olympics. So it's like this guy's worked his entire life and he can't go. And then, you know, a producer saw him like in an advert and was like, well, we can craft a film around this guy. Like James Bond, but with parallel bars. Actually, when we screened Jim Carter in January, I was lucky enough to track him down and I managed to ask him about that. We've got an interview for that on our website as well. And I actually asked him about the scene where he's on the pommel horse in the square. And apparently all the crazy people in that scene are actually people from a local asylum. They got a bunch of local crazy people and essentially fed them for the day and got them in that scene, except the people that he kicks in the face are stuntmen. But apart from that, everyone else there is insane.
What's he doing with himself these days?
He runs a gymnastics school in Texas. I think it's Dallas. Wow. Somewhere in Texas, yeah.
So instead of YKKM spraying Taekwondo awareness, he's spraying gymnastics awareness.
I did actually ask him if any of his students have seen it, and he was like, I think a couple of them have. I didn't exactly mention it. And he's kind of watched it. Whenever it comes on TV, he sort of says he catches it. But yeah, he focuses on actually being a professional gymnast instructor these days rather than an action star. Which is a shame, because the man has some moves.
Yeah, no, I mean, he can do those, work those uneven parallel bars like nobody's business. I mean, I've never seen, save for maybe John Stamos and Never Too Young to Die. I don't know if you've seen that one.
That is my planned alternative programming for when the new Bond film comes out.
Yes.
Never Too Young to Die, it's got George Lazenby in, Vanity.
Whoa.
And it's got, this is the one with the hermaphrodite.
Yeah,
it's wow. I won't say more. I'll let you discover the choice.
It's pretty fantastic.
It's incredible. So and you know, as you were saying before, though, I mean, again, like, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, these films, like back in the day, it's like the studio said, you know, and be it like Orion or Canon or what have you. It's like, okay, you got this batshit crazy idea. Won't cost that much money. Go make it. And we have these incredible films to watch now and to love and just to enhance our lives. You know, these movies enhance our lives, I think. You know?
And it just makes a great night out. If you just have some friends, you have some beers, and you're just watching these films.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, nothing brings people together better than a bad film. It's just that shared disbelief of what you're watching, kind of going, oh my god, this is an actual film. Someone actually wrote and directed this and thought this would be a great idea. That's amazing.
And money was put into this too, which is also something, you know.
Someone financed this and went, yeah, I'm happy to pay for this.
Yep. And so, I mean, unfortunately, like, and see, you know, the thing is, I mean, like, there are the exceptions, but unfortunately nowadays, it seems like the movies, like, that we do get, these bad movies, I mean, they're self-conscious bad movies, i.e. your Sharknados and stuff. And, I mean, I have no use for that whatsoever, because, you know, it's like the second wave of whatever. It's like, okay, well, Punk came out, and, you know, the ideals were there. It was lofty. There was some real sort of, like, there was something behind it, right? And then when you have the second wave, the third wave, and it gets watered down. I mean, so now when you have your Sharknados and its ilk, it's not the same, you know? It's not an organic bad movie.
Yeah, no, I'd agree. I'd never do a screening of something like Sharknado or, you know, Mega Shark versus Mecha Shark. Because these films are kind of winking at the camera and they're made to be deliberately bad. Whereas, you know, the films that are really funny and really entertaining, it's like that complete lack of awareness.
Exactly.
Of what they were doing was bad. But if you're making a film like Sharknado 3 where you have the Hoff in it, it's like, you know what kind of film you're making.
Yeah, although I will say I did like Piranha 3 Double D or Triple D or whatever the heck it was called. I had a fun time with that one. But no, it's true. I mean, that's the thing. Like, with these movies we're talking about, everyone involved, especially the ones when the, you know, the same guys, like the writing, producing, directing, it's like, this is my masterpiece. This is my grand statement. I'm going to leave the world, you know? And then it comes out like this gigantic pile of poo. But it's just, it's so lovable and endearing. And we love it. And it's great that what you guys are doing over there and you know, in England. And you're, you know, the BBFC, man. The other BBFC.
Yeah, that was a... Yeah, the guy I started it with, he came up with that, and yeah, it's a pretty damn good nickname, actually. It works really well. The only problem is now when I'm trying to get interviews with people, and I go, oh no, I'm from the Bristol Bad Film Club, I have to kind of lie and just say I'm from a cult film club, because I don't want these people to think that I'm mocking their films.
Yep.
I really like their films. I mean, the Bad Film Club was a great title for when we set it up so that people knew what we were showing. And it's great in that, on that hand, but on the other, when you're trying to get permission to do some of these films, we don't want the directors. Tommy Wiseau is a classic example. He does not let anyone screen his film who is taking the piss, essentially. So I have to use a different email address and... just say, no, I really love your film. It's all for charity. I don't say what we're called. I just say I'm doing a charity screening of the film. Because I really love his film, and I don't want him to think that I'm...
Does he think he's Orson Welles or something?
He thinks... Well, from what I've read, he thought he was the next Tennessee Williams in the room. It was meant to be his streetcar named Desire.
Have you read The Disaster Artist by Greg Sestero?
I have, yeah. I know. I met Greg and Tommy last year when they came to London.
Yeah.
And, I was lucky enough to get Greg to sign my copy. And he's a really nice guy. Mm-hmm. He's very much aware that when he goes to these things, it's all Tommy's show, and he's essentially just window dressing. But this is the film that's, you know, let him travel the world. And for better or worse, he's forever going to be known as Mark from The Room. So...
That amazes me, too, because I also met the two of them here in a screening of The Room in Toronto, and this was before The Disaster Artist, and when I read that book, I said to myself, there's absolutely no way that Tommy and Greg can still be friends. I mean, he totally peels back a lot of the, for lack of a better term, mystique of Tommy Wiseau, and I'm like, I thought to myself, I mean, Tommy, he's so guarded, he's so, you know, like, And Greg definitely peels back a lot of the layers, and it's a great read. It's funny, so they're still touring together. They're still friends. I'm amazed.
Yeah, well, I mean, Tommy always kind of says, "Oh, you know, it's just a book. Greg doesn't know everything about me, or he kind of, Greg might have been exaggerating about certain things, but." When you're reading, you're like, no, I completely believe all of this.
It's so good. Yeah, man, you gotta love Tommy Wiseau. I mean, I don't think there's a more self-deluded man on this planet, but whatever. You gotta, good for him. God bless him. I love the guy, you know? And I'm waiting for his follow-up to The Room. When's that gonna come out?
Well, I think you guys can watch it. He's made that web series, The Neighbors, that I think you can watch on Hulu.
He's got a bit of a Catcher in the Rye kind of thing. He's just got his one masterpiece, and then he's just sitting on his laurels there.
Sort of.
And I want to see more.
Mm-hmm. If
Harper Lee has a new book after To Kill a Mockingbird, that only took her, what, 4 decades?
Yeah.
Come on. I want Wiseau.
Get people together that will want to work with him and him trying to find the money to, you know, finance his next epic.
Mm-hmm.
I would definitely be first in line to see it.
Well, it's also like the whole thing with, like, Seinfeld, right? You know, George Costanza, always leave on a high note, you know?
Yeah.
It's like he made his masterpiece, you know? This is The Room, I've done it. Okay, goodbye, good night, everybody. I'm done. This is my Citizen Kane, or this is my Streetcar Named Desire. I have done it, and it's up to the rest of you to realize my genius. You will come around to me. That's the end of that, you know? The hubris of Tommy Wiseau.
It's been 10 years now, hasn't it? It's been out for 10 years.
It has.
Like $6 million. He must have made all his money back from the amount of screenings that happened.
I'm sure. Yeah. Well, he must have at this point, yep.
And he's going to be in Samurai Cop 2.
He is, Robert Zadar, you know, I'm still heartbroken over that.
That was tragic. Yeah, I was kind of upset because I don't think he'd shot his stuff yet.
He had. He was on his way to shoot his scenes, and yeah, I mean, it's a loss. I don't know what it is, but to this day I'm still affected. I'm still mourning the loss of Robert Zadar. I don't know why I'm so affected, but I just really am. I've
managed to move on.
You've moved on?
Yeah.
I'm finding some difficulty.
Brett, yeah. No, I mean, for me, I will always think of him as like the maniac cop. Uh-huh. But Samurai Cop, and then also his role as, he's called Face, isn't he, in Tango and Cash?
Yes.
He's just one of those kind of defining cult actors who, I mean, he's so recognizable. Though that chin.
Oh my god, yeah.
You always kind of wish he'd been in more stuff, but yeah. That's why I was really looking forward to Samurai Cop 2, but...
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm still looking forward to it. I just wish that we... Because everybody is coming back, all the main principals, but I mean...
Yeah, unfortunately, pretty much.
And Zadar was supposed to reprise his role as...
Are there going
to
be any more Japanese people in this?
More than the original?
More than the one?
Yeah.
The main crime lord's back in it. The guy who wants his head on his piano.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
So, yeah, no, it should be good fun, as long as they... They're not going to be able to replicate the insanity of Samurai Cop, so no. I guess you want a certain level of awareness, and you just kind of want to make it a batshit insane action film. You don't want to try and be a deliberately bad film, so it's going to be really interesting tonally to see what they do.
Well, I mean, with Weasel anywhere near the production, it's going to be batshit. He just, like, you know what I mean? Like he somehow infects everything he comes across, so it's going to be nuts, I think.
Yeah.
It should be fun to see.
Alright, well, I guess we're going to wrap up this little chat here.
Great, okay.
And, yeah, thanks for talking to us. It's been a pleasure.
It's been a pleasure, yeah, definitely. And hopefully one of these days we can make our way over there and catch one of your screenings.
Oh, brilliant. Well, thanks for having me on, guys. It's been really good. And thanks for introducing me to Vigilante. It was a really good film.
That's the thing. Unfortunately,
yeah,
it was a really good film.
A little disappointed, ironically.
we're happy, but at the same time, we're like...
about it. No, it was really good. Really enjoyed it. So thanks for having me on.
No,
and
thanks a lot.
Thank you, and hopefully we'll talk again soon.
Yeah, brilliant. All right. Cheers.
Take
thanks,
care.
Guys.
See ya. Thank you.